G'day and welcome to the FIFO podcast. I'm Paul Smith, the founder of Freedom in Finding Ourselves, and this podcast is all about FIFO, the good, the bad, and the ugly. The aim is to share a message with you from men and women that have struggled and overcome their own FIFO battles. I hope through this you can realise you're not alone and you can learn from others how they went on to turning their life around and leaving the industry, and also those that have implemented some key structures and strategies to make sure the FIFO lifestyle works for them. Well, welcome to the next episode of the Surviving FIFO podcast. And today I've got a really special guest, Thomas Christensen. Thomas is living and working the FIFO lifestyle from WA. He's got an amazing story, one of survival, one of resilience, one of rebuilding his life after a serious motorbike accident on his 13th birthday almost cost him his life. Having been in a coma for 7 weeks and after 3 to 4 years of intense rehab, he's now back living his life to the best of his ability and sharing his journey with people all across the world as well. So I look forward to sharing this with him and diving deep into how FIFO has changed his life and how he now deals with living that lifestyle. Enjoy the episode, guys. Welcome, guys. And today I'm really privileged to be able to have the chat to Thomas Christensen. He's a FIFO guy. He's living in WA. He's working away up there in Carrara. And look, he's got a really amazing story. I'm going to let him dive into the story in some detail for you for what he's willing to share. But, you know, to start with, you know, at 13 years of age, you know, Thomas had a serious motorbike accident and, you know, that almost cost him his life. 7 weeks in a coma he spent, and he's been able to rebuild his life from there. He's been able to turn it around, and now he's been able to share his journey with other people, and he's been able to speak on stage and really bring awareness into the realities of his life and the realities of other people out there that have struggled with serious trauma like he has himself. But I'll let him dive into that a bit more. So welcome, mate. I really appreciate your time, and it's fantastic to have a chat and catch up face-to-face finally too.
Yeah, thank you very much, Paul. Really appreciate it. I'll touch on one thing before I start. I didn't almost end my life. Actually, I did. So that's one thing I should make sure. So I suppose I'll just jump straight into it.
Wow, that's massive. I probably should have mentioned that. You did actually pass away for 12 minutes.
I did.
That makes the story even more amazing, mate, to be able to now sit here and have that conversation with you. So, yeah, take it away, buddy.
Awesome. So it's my 13th birthday of all days, you know, lucky 13. So I woke up, got a call from my best friend, said, oh, you know, we've got this new motorbike. We've been, you know, looking at these bikes online for a while. And so yeah, I think we must have bought one a couple of weeks prior to my birthday or something like that. I'm not too sure. He gives me a call and says, the bike just arrived, you know, do you want to come and help, you know, build it with. All right, yeah, no worries, and I'll come around and help you put it together. Because, I mean, we're always doing this sort of stuff as kids anyway. So, we knew what we were doing, confident with it. You know, there was never sort of an issue, you know, about that. So, you know, I rushed over to the house and we got started to putting the bike together. And you know, loving it, having fun, laughing, you know, everything good. And we put the bike together and he says, do you want to go for a ride? And we both let's go away, we're going to test it out. And the bike that we had was a 250cc. So I think the biggest bike we had around it, or we were around at the time, were probably the 175s or, you know, things along 175 or the 180s, something like that, I'm not too sure. So, you know, it's a big bike. So I don't think we really had the skills to, or we didn't understand the actual power that the bike had. So yeah, anyway, so we said, yeah, let's go for a ride. Let's take it, see what we can do with it, and blah, blah, blah. But I didn't have my helmet at the time. You know, I just sort of rushed over to the house. I was excited, you know, my 13th birthday, new motorbike arrived. So sort of just straight out the house to his house, you know, not taking my helmet with me. Said, you know, I don't have my helmet, mate. Don't have my helmet. You know, we need to sort of get that somehow. So we thought the best way for me to jump on the back of the bike as a passenger and for him to ride it, and, you know, because he had the helmet on. because we, you know, we're kids. We didn't really understand that the actual danger, you know, for him and for me, was the same. You know, we were both on the bike, whether he was riding it or he was the passenger. You know, we're both, you know, in that sort of that same danger. So I jumped on the back of the bike and said, you know, let's go to my house and get my helmet. All right, let's go. You know, start the bike up. Or love, you know, loved it. You know, the sound of the engine, you know, things like that always, you know, lifted us up, and we love that sort of stuff. So jump back on the bike and, you know, off we went, and come out of his road and then turn right onto this main road. And then I'd say I wouldn't even be 30 metres, 30, 40 metres, there was a park on the left-hand side. It was a big park near. You know, there was a lot of families there at the time. This was like 2008, so a lot of families there at the time, kids there playing at the playground, things like that. And, you know, we were kids, you know, when we every now and then we're a bit smart, you know, we'd revel up, you know, to get a bit of a lift out of people, see how they'd react. We did that, and then off we went, you know, flying, speed, you know, I don't know how fast we were going. But then the park went, so we'd gone like from the start of the park to the end of the park, and right before the park ended, the road was there. So we were just about to, you know, take this right turn to get back on the road, and boom, you know, that crash. And I don't know what caused the crash and how it happened. I'm not sure about that. But, you know, either way, we crashed. And, you know, I'll touch on this a bit more later, but there was a tree there. So when we crashed, like, my mate had gone forward and missed the tree, but I had been wrapped around the tree. So I'd been wrapped around on the right-hand side, and I, you know, broke three ribs, punctured my right lung, fractured my skull, bleeding on the brain, you know, and dead instantly. Which, you know, I'll come back on that one, but dead instantly. And then everyone that was at the park sort of rushed over and, you know, because this big commotion, I heard this big crash, and, you know, are these kids okay? You know, that's what they were thinking. They rushed over and then, you know, didn't want to do anything because, like, spinal damage is definitely, you know, it was a big possibility. So, you know, they didn't want to move me. They didn't want to do anything because, you know, they weren't doctors. You know, they weren't sure what to do. Within, I don't know the topic, but somehow that worked out. We got 12 minutes of death. But there was a woman that was driving past from my nephew's birthday party, who was a nurse, and saw all this commotion. Just, you know, she was a bit worried. And a bit of a fun fact, you know, her nephew had the same name as me. I don't know, you know, something there. But so she, you know, she pulled over, saw all the commotion, saw that I was on my stomach, rolled me over onto my back, you know, with, you know, spinal damage was the possibility. And my skin was blue. Like, it was just, from what I was told, it wasn't like a shade of blue. It was just complete blue. Like, it didn't look like a normal skin color. So she started CPR, and, you know, the ambulance had already been called because, you know, people that were at the park at the time had called the ambulance. So that was, you know, ambulance was on its way. The nurse kept on giving me CPR and couldn't get a heartbeat. So the ambulance arrived, and, you know, this nurse, I can never thank her enough. You know, she's always got my utmost respect, and, you know, I love every single thing that, you know, about her. She jumped in the back of the ambulance with me, still give me CPR because there's no heartbeat. And, you know, she continued CPR, and the ambulance, the closest hospital at the time from where I was Fremantle Hospital. So, you know, they're heading there, and then they didn't actually get a heartbeat until we got to Adventure World. So that was, I think they worked out it would have been about 6 minutes in the ambulance. It would have been about 6 minutes before the ambulance arrived. So that's how it worked out, is, you know, about 12 minutes to death. And rushed Fremantle Hospital, put on some life support. You know, doctors immediately said, you know, this is not going to end well. We said, look at done and what they know with the education they had, this isn't looking good. They put me on, you know, life support. They don't think they really want to do. We have to, this is something I found out a bit later, because I had to go to PMH, being the children's hospital. Lovely, lovely hospital. We found this out a bit later, you know, once I'd sort of been dismissed from the hospital. The doctors at Fremantle had told the doctors at PMH that they were transferring an organ. So, you know, what they meant by that was, you know, this guy, he's on life support, you know, you could try and help him, blah, 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 but he's not gonna be coming out of it. So rush PMH, put into a coma, and yep, 7 weeks, and every single week of that coma, well, I think it was up until probably the fourth week, was nothing but sort of negative news from the doctor. You know, nothing but bad news. You know, this is not looking good, it's not looking good, there's no sort of progress with his brainwave, things like that. And, you know, doctors kept on telling my parents, you know, that we need to turn the life support off because it's not looking good. Like, they were giving them the details and giving them the education that they had to, you know, justify what they were saying. You know, but these are my parents, you know, they're not going to say, you know, they're not going to turn my life support off. You know, that's, I think, it comes down to the strength of them, you know, to be able to sort of, to be able to say no to that sort of, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah, so I think it would have been within the last three, or third last week or second last week of my coma, I was starting to get a bit of, you know, a bit of brain function. You know, things starting to happen, and they didn't really know why. And, you know, on the last week of the coma, because I was in ICU for I think the first 4 weeks, I think it was, and then I was transferred to a normal hospital ward for the last three. And where I was put in the last 3 weeks of that ward was not far from a girl who was struggling with autism. I think she might have been struggling with a few other things, I'm not too sure. But her condition led her to have violent outbursts, and, you know, she would scream a lot, she would try and abuse, you know, the hospital staff, things like that. And, you know, my family had been dealing with it, you know, for the last 3 weeks or so. And on the day that I woke up from the coma, actually woke up because of this, the girl, you know, that was struggling with this was running, you know, had gotten out of her room and was running down the hall, screaming. She was swearing at the doctors. She was, you know, being a bit violent, things like that. She was getting close to my room, and my mom slammed my door shut and, excuse my language, said, "Shut the fuck up." And then the girl was like, next minute I start laughing, which is, I think, the best way to wake up from a coma. You know, so I start laughing, you know, I couldn't say anything, couldn't do anything, couldn't see, you know, I started just, you know, Ben was like, what's happening? He's laughing, you know, what's going on? Calls the doctor in, my son's laughing, is he awake or what? Oh my God, don't know. So, and that was, yeah, that was a, I suppose, awakening of the coma. Yeah, which is quite bizarre thing. Well, I think that's the best way to wake up, you know, laughing with a smile.
Wow, and, mate, yeah, that's an epic story. Oh, yeah.
After that. Yeah. it's a pretty crazy one.
Mate, I mean, the resilience that you've obviously... Keep going, mate. Sorry. Well, keep going. That was...
Oh, yeah. No. I suppose, trying to cover it in, you know, one podcast would be a long one. So that, you know, that's when the rehab started. Things like that. And rehab, also, you know, for the most part, it wasn't giving me much hope, you know. The most part of saying, you know, this is going to be in a wheelchair for the rest of his life. I wasn't in a wheelchair, you know. Couldn't talk, couldn't eat, couldn't drink, you know. Still had tubes down my throat and tubes up my nose and, you know, all this sort of stuff. So, you know, their prediction, you know, for my rehab still, you know, wasn't that good. Yeah, that's when my family come in, you know, hold on, you were sort of saying that he's not waking up from home. You were saying that, you know, for 4 or 5 weeks, and he did that. So, you know, that you know, they developed this mindset saying, you know, just because someone, you know, says that it's not going to happen doesn't mean it's correct, you know. Just because the, with what they knew, doesn't mean that their opinion is necessarily correct. I mean, we've got to sort of believe what doctors say because that's their job and that's what they're trained to do and that's what they've done. But I mean, when it comes down to an individual, you do have to rebel against these negative sort of thoughts. So that's what they did. So, you know, the rehab sort of started and, it was a long, long, long process and it was a painful one. Because, you know, painful one trying to still do the rehab and being told that, you know, you're not going to make a full recovery. So, you know, I'm working, you know, I'm doing, you know, 5 different sessions of rehab every day for, you know, 2 years until I went to part-time rehab. And, you know, trying to do that every day and trying to put the negative comments to rest, I guess. So trying to do, you know, my rehab and that same time, definitely, you know, it took a toll. And it's a hard thing to...
As a 13-year-old boy at that, you know, that teenage years, and you've got that freedom, or you're just coming into that freedom, and then to have that taken away from you in, you know, the blink of an eye, what was it like to actually have to relearn and to reteach yourself what you thought you knew, or how did you reteach yourself to actually firstly learn all those things again, but did it take you on a different path of where you thought you may have been going, if you had the recollection of previously, of course?
A big, big, big difference, yeah. I don't have a lot of memory of my childhood today. I mean, I've got bits and bobs here and there, but I don't have a lot of it. The most of it is, you know, from you know, post-accident kind of thing. I do have a little bit, but, yeah, it does, you know. I had to develop a whole new sort of mindset again, you know, a whole new way of thinking. And probably the way I did that was education, you know, getting education from different people, getting different people's thoughts on how they fix things and how they deal with issues and how they overcome things, and then trying to make my own or trying to develop my own understanding from that. So I think that's it. That, yeah, but definitely it was a long, long process for sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
Do you now see that episode, whilst it's a hard way to put it, but do you see that as a somewhat a blessing in your life to be able to change tact, even though you went through significant trauma and injury through that process? Do you feel that you've taken a completely different path that you may have been on? And do you see that as, obviously it's a pivotal moment, but do you see that as a defining moment that you've now been able to, you know, what you get to do now would never have been possible without this story?
I do agree with that. So since then, you know, I have done motivational speaking. I've met some, you know, amazing people. So, and it comes down, yeah, that wouldn't have happened, you know, if this hadn't happened. You know, I've helped people that do have, you know, traumatic experience as well, you know, PTSD, things like that. I have sort of a broader understanding of, you know, how they think now. And, you know, I understand where they're coming from a bit better. But I think, for me, like one thing that hasn't changed is my creativity. Because I know, you know, when I was a kid, I was always building things. Like me and my friends were always building things like that. So I suppose the creativity that I had as a kid, I used to redevelop myself and to, you know, to relearn how to walk again. And I had to do it a different way, you know, because the old way wasn't working, kind of thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I had to be creative about it, and, you know, I had to think, okay, so this isn't working. What can I do differently to make it work, to support my goal? You know, so say my goal, you know, was walking. If I walked a certain way, you know, heel first, I'd get too much pain down my calf or something like that, or get pain in my ankles. So I'd have to walk flat footed for a little bit, and then once that sort of, you know, once that pain came, I'd have to go back to heel toe, things like that. So developing a new way of, you know, doing things, and that was on a regular basis. Yeah, so I think that, yeah, that was the biggest help with just trying to learn how to adapt.
I love that you use the word adapt there. And for those people out there listening on the podcast and things, that, you know, so often in life we come up with these challenges, some obviously not as significant of what you've been through, but what we do know is that if we allow ourselves to pivot and to adapt to the circumstances, then we actually can relearn and we can change our path, or we can do something differently to allow us to get out of the place that we might feel stuck in the moment. What would you say on that to people out there listening?
Yeah, so for that, I'd say, because a lot of people that I speak to now, you know, about sort of mental health, you know, if they're struggling, things like that, one thing that I've found is they don't necessarily understand where it's coming from. Well, you know, a lot of the times they do, you know, but I think it's more... yeah, developing a better understanding of what the problem is. And that's sort of come back to creativity, you know. Maybe it wasn't that. Maybe it is. And if it is, it's about how you're going to fix it. You know, if one thing doesn't work, try a different thing. And if that doesn't work, try a bit of both. You know, that's always going to be sort of my thoughts on overcoming things that, yeah, that are, you know, sitting back. And I suppose, you know, being 25 in 25 in November, I don't have the understanding, you know, that a lot of people do, you know, that have kids and mortgages and things like that. So I don't have that understanding, but talking about that and sort of getting creative about the way you think about it, thinking about a different way, I think, is, yeah, it's definitely beneficial. It's not necessarily going to be, you know, the best way for everyone, but for me, I think it is, because it's not a yes or no sort of question, not do this or do that. Sort of thinking about what actually needs to be done and just sort of getting a better understanding about that.
Yeah, that's right. And I see it so often, you know, in that coaching space, and it's about sharing a different perspective. And when people can see things from a different perspective, it allows them to think differently, which allows them to then find their own path, a path that they've created for themselves, but they've just been able to realize there is something different that they can do. And mate, it's a massive story. And to change tact a little bit now, how has that led you into, and when did you get into that FIFO space? Obviously, you know, 3 or 4 years. So you're nearly 18 by the time you get out of rehab and you're sort of back into the workforce maybe then. Were you able to start then? And how did that progression, once getting back into the workforce, land you in the FIFO space?
Always sort of loved, you know, being around people and communication, things. I've always, you know, loved sort of learning about, you know, different things like that. So I tried to just, you know, a few different jobs working in Perth before I started the FIFO industry, like working in the FIFO industry. But my father and, you know, I've got quite a few other family members and friends that have been in it, you know, more or less since we came to Australia. So I had, you know, the basic understanding of what it was like. And the way, you know, I was sort of told about it, which is what I believe now, is sort of a family atmosphere. If you know, if people allow it to be, I think that's what sort of drew me to it, was the camaraderie between workmates and, yeah, the camaraderie and just the general sort of understanding of, like, everyone's sort of on the same level. Well, not this, but I mean, everyone's sort of there to, you know, to do the job and to do that, you know, being away from the family, things like that, they build, or we, that's what I've been sort of around anyways, we build like a family atmosphere and sort of a whole new community on site. So I think that's what drew me to it. And then, you know, along with that, sort of the 12-hour shift, which spends a bit more money and things like that. So, yeah, that's what drew me to it. And I love it, yeah.
How important do you think it is to build those communities inside that FIFO space? So you've got that support network, you've got that vent, or you've got that outlet outside of the actual work hours. How important is that not only to you but to other people?
Yeah, extremely important, I think. And it's, I think where a lot of people don't understand is the majority of people that are in the FIFO industry, the ones I've spoken to anyways, want that as well. You know, they want that community. They want to, you know, because they're away from their family, they want to be around people that share, you know, common interests and want, you know, that working relationship. And it's not, I don't think it's a hard thing to do. And, you know, it just builds on that, you know, people want to be a part of it, and people want to be, you know, they want to be happy, they want to be, enjoy their workspace, and I think building that community definitely helps.
And do you see it with many in there, or do you see, you know, obviously there's always little groups within the groups, and there's always, yep, you know, little packs, if you want to call it that, whatever. Do you see it enough, or do you still see so many people out there in your experience that maybe shying away from that, or, you know, become that self-isolated because they just don't want to be around people at the end of the day?
Yeah, I see on that, probably more so the people that, don't want to be around it, but I don't know where that sort of thinking coming from. And I don't know whether, you know, that's their intent, you know, want to or not, possibly yes, possibly no, but that's sort of, I think, a lot of it would come down to experience, I suppose. Mm. Being in the industry, you know, for a little while, and, you know, understanding the ins and outs of it makes a big difference, I think. Mm.
Do you have a routine that you stick to while you're in your camp life? And what's your roster, and how does that routine work for you?
At the moment, it's not a roster. It's a shutdown basis.
Mm-hmm.
But if I can, I'll go back to my last site, so the one I was at before this. That was Tropicana. So my roster there was 5-2-4-3. So I was on site every week and just home for the weekends. And that is 100%, no doubt about it, necessary for us. And that's what it is. So we'd fly up every Monday, and we'd go straight to the office. I was in Clayton. We'd go straight to the office, work the Monday, do the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, 1 week, then fly home Thursday night, and then we'd do Monday to Friday the next week, and fly home on the Friday that night. And when you in a roster like that, you know, you're more or less on site more than you're at home. It's 100% necessary to develop a roster, which is what I did. Which is what I did. So usually, I'd wake up, I'd go for a bit of a walk around camp prior to, you know, going for a dinner or, you know, things like that for some days or nights. And then, you know, I'd go to work, I'd come back, and I'd, you know, have a chat with the guys. And depending on, you know, that last sort of few hours of the day is where, you know, I can get creative about, you know, what I want to do, things like that.
Yeah, nice. And I mean, and it's so important to have that structure that works for you. And no two people, I believe, can have the same routine. You have to find, you have to implement stuff that works for you. And that needs to be flexible and needs to be able to change. And I believe, you know, whether it's week on, week off, or every, you know, every swing that you're on, I believe being able to implement a structure and a routine into each swing
is so important, because so many conditions or so many things change in your life over those few weeks. You know, it might be as simple as the weather conditions, or something's happened at home and the thought place is maybe not where it was the previous swing. You know, you ride those ebbs and flows. So how important is it that you be able to be flexible with that for you? And do you see enough people doing it?
I don't see enough people doing it. I don't see enough people doing it, but it is really important, because, like you say, like being flexible about the routine, because, like, you know, things change at home, things change on site. Having that routine and being able to make those small changes when necessary, like when one thing isn't working, you know, being able to make those small changes is an important part of FIFO. I do believe that. I agree. And this is, I think, comes back to the aspect as well, and that a lot of people, you know, they do want to help. So, you know, when a routine needs to be changed, a lot of the time, especially for men, excuse me, especially for men, you know, they don't want to speak about, you know, oh, I've got to change this because this is happening at home. But the support is there, and everyone, not everyone, but a lot of people, you know, they are on your side and they do want to help. And I think, if people are struggling to sort of make those adjustments to routine, I think it's important to speak to people and to, you know, speak to your workmates, speak to your family, and, you know, make those changes and, get creative about it.
Get creative about it. I love that. And, you know, one of the biggest things I like to share with people is that being creative, you know, when it talk about we're doing exercise, when we talk about creating a routine or a structure, when you can be creative and it doesn't get boring, you can do something different all the time. It's always that thought place of it's something new. If you know that you need to go to the gym for 45 minutes every single day and do the same old workout, leg day, shoulder day, bicep day, whatever, then you soon lose that excitement to go and do it, because it just becomes the mundane work task. It just becomes the same old cycle of I'm going to work for 12 hours, I'm coming home to do the same old 45-minute gym session, I'm going to eat, I'm going to sleep, repeat, repeat, repeat for God knows how long ever your roster is. If you can be creative and change that, how does that affect and change the mindset of the person that allows them to feel like they're in control then?
Being creative, you know, with a routine, with ink, opens up doors to different, you know, different things, different way of thinking. And, you know, once you've done that, being creative about that opens up further doors. So I think it's sort of it broadens the mind a lot. So like for routine, for working out. So normally, you know, when I was training, when I was back in my rehab or after my rehab, I went through, you know, probably 3 years of solid training. And it was the same routine, you know, week in, week out. And, you know, for a while that did work for me. That you know, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed how my body reacted to that. But I got to a point where, you know, where it didn't anymore. So that's where I thought I had to, again, like to change it up a little bit, get creative. And so I stopped, you know, training every day. I started doing it every second day. And then, you know, did different workouts, things like that, which it completely changes the approach or the way you're sort of thinking about the task. It changes that completely. Like sort of, I guess, comes down to like for you, your body surfing or your surfing, things like that. You know, there's different ways, and that's always changing. You know, it's always different. You know, different conditions, different people at the beach. So being able to, be flexible about and, learning different ways to do things. And, you know, things stem from that you don't necessarily know would stem from it, or you don't necessarily expect to come from it. I've had it, many times where, you know, I'd be doing something and I'd change something up, and then I'd meet someone who would invite me, or, you know, show me a different way of doing things, or invite me just to something else, and then boom, a whole new way of, or a whole new sort of interest maybe, or a whole new way of doing what I was doing originally. So,
I love how you put that back to relating it to your own story and the rehab that you had to go through for, you know, those 3 years or whatever, that long period of time. But you got to a point where it wasn't working and you needed to change. Yes, that was the advice and that was everything, and it served its purpose to that point. When you compare that to your own cycle of work-life balance, when you get to that point where you can recognize that it's not working, the ability to change it in that moment allows you to freshen it up. It allows you to grow. And it's like everything. We're always going to get to that glass ceiling where if we don't break through that, if we don't do something differently to what we already know, then we're never going to continue to grow. And we're not going to get the results that we want to get to. And, you know, you're walking proof that that is the reality of it. And your story to get to this point is, you know, it's fantastic. And I love that you get to share that with people now, because there'd be so many people out there in a lesser, that would have a lesser story, not to discount their story, but wouldn't have the trauma or the life story that you've been through, yet feel so stuck in life that they can't change anything. They can't pivot. They can't take that different path, yet you're living, walking proof that it's possible even after the most extreme circumstance.
Yeah. Yeah. And I suppose that's sort of, you know, where I come from now. And that's what my goal is, to help with that, because I'm seeing it quite a bit, and it doesn't seem to be, you know, going away anytime soon, you know, these sorts of issues. So yeah, it's. Just trying to help people think a bit differently about the situation that they may have gone through at the moment, or go about it with the different approach, I suppose. You know, that's my goal, is to help people know that this isn't necessarily the only way of doing stuff, and if that's not working, then try something else. Be creative about it. Do something different. And if that doesn't work, try something else again. Do something else and learn from people, and, you know, take on, you know, different advice, and adapt to what works for you, I suppose, to what best serves the purpose, I guess. Yeah.
Well, it's a great message, and we do it in work. We do it in work every single day. If things aren't working, we sit down and we have a conversation, or we find a different way to make the outcome work. Yet so many people don't do it in their own lives, hence why they feel so stuck. If they just gave themselves that 5 minutes to step back and take themselves out of that situation, then maybe they would see that clearer path. They would see that new perspective, and they'd have that aha moment, or whatever you want to call it, and go, all right, I just need to do this in order to get there. So why don't we do that? Why don't we do it in our own lives? Yet when we're getting paid to do it, we take the time, we do it because we think it's important.
Yeah.
Yet it's so much more important in our own lives.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a difficult one to answer. I think, that's, especially for FIFO workers, a lot of people think, you know, there's a work life, and then there's a home life. And sort of, I think, with a lot of issues like for mental health and firefight, is being able to sort of, or not being able to identify the difference between the two. So, and, or not being able to work with both of them and be able to, you know, adapt to the changes that are required, and to implement, you know, strategies that they're learning, you know, in both, you know, work life and home life. I mean, it's not necessarily going to be a one strategy that's going to work for both. There's probably not, you know, if I'm honest about it. That's where creativity for me comes back. So being able to learn, you know, what needs to be done at home to help what you're doing at work, I suppose, or and what he's done at work to help at home. And yeah, it's different for everyone, but the only way to sort of to figure that out and to find that out is to be creative about it, to talk to people and take different ideas and you know, develop the strategies that will help, you know, the individual.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And there is only life. So we have to create that balance that works for us. And when we can implement those, you know, I talk about it a lot with what I do, that is those six key elements to allow us to create that, you know, that structure and that balance and to have all those things working for you, then you can realize that, you know, what you do at home impacts what you do at work and vice versa so much. When you can get that balance right, then you can have a very productive FIFO career, and you can actually achieve the specific outcomes that you want to achieve if you do it correctly. Otherwise, you're just on that hamster wheel forever, chasing that weekly wage, living day to day, and you just forget about why you actually went there for, to set yourself up and to get ahead, knowing that you were going to get probably paid that little bit more to be able to be there. So, so what would you suggest to people out there? What's that number one tip from a FIFO, you know, a lived experience guy that still works in the environment? What's the biggest takeaway or what's the biggest bit of advice that you feel that you could give to people?
Biggest advice would be to, I've said it, you know, quite a few times in this podcast, probably too much. Be creative about, you know, what you're doing. Be, you know, take different ideas on it, and if it's not working, then try something else. You know, that I think that would be my biggest thing, is get creative about, you know, how you're doing things, and don't necessarily accept that, you know, one thing is right. Don't necessarily accept that, you know, what Bob, Jeff, or, you know, Dylan or Sam talk, you know, don't necessarily believe that, you know, what they've said is correct. Take their advice, take it on board. You know, listen to it, adapt it, you know, into your own life, and then think about, you know, is what they've, you know, told me, is what they've done for me, you know, helping me and helping my course. If not, then you know, find something else. You know, listen to the podcast, listen to the teachers, learn, you know, learn from people that not. I think that would be my biggest advice, is just to learn and, you know, get creative about how you can adapt, you know, the newfound intuition, I suppose, or newfound, you know, teaching. Yeah.
I love that. Be creative. Give it a chance to play out. If it's not working, have the ability to change it and be creative again. It's an ever evolving thing, just like life. And if we can take that in and we can understand that, then it should never be dull and boring, because we're always learning and we're always creating a new way to do things. That's awesome. Yeah. And look, mate, I know that you run a Facebook page. I know that you do guest speaking and you get to share your story with so many people. If people wanted to get in touch with you, where do they find you? Tell us a little bit about what you do outside of the FIFO space. And if people want to, you know, get in touch, you know, where's it all happening?
Thomas Christensen on Facebook. That'd be the best bet. So there's also me and a couple of friends have been doing it for a while. A few friends doing it for a while now. There's a Facebook page called Guard Life, so GUARD Life. So that's sort of all about, you know, community building and, you know, bringing the people that have the best intentions, you know, together and, you know, trying to figure out different ways, you know, to adapt to, you know, a changing world and get creative about. So yeah, I think if people want to get in touch, I'd say Thomas Christensen on Facebook would be the way to go.
Beautiful, mate. Well, we'll pop a link in to the podcast so people can find you there. We'll pop a link into the Guard Life Facebook group as well, so they can find you and check out what the good work that you guys are doing in that page as well. And, you know, I really appreciate you sharing a little bit of insight into your life and into your FIFO journey. And for the people out there listening, I'd love you to, you know, to like this and share this around and share it with someone that may resonate. And, you know, if you ever need to chat to someone, don't be too afraid to put your hand up. Be creative. Enjoy your FIFO life, because you are making the sacrifices, you know, for your family for the right reasons, still for the right reasons, and you can certainly survive and thrive. So, mate, I really appreciate it, and we'll be still in touch for sure. So Thank you.
We will. Thank you very much, Paul. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for tuning in today, guys, and I hope you did get some value from that today. Hope you enjoyed the story that you may have just heard. And if you did get some value, I'd appreciate and be very grateful if you could like and share this podcast with other people, because there might be someone out there that might be struggling today that just needs to hear the story from someone else, to realize that they're not alone, to realize that there is hope, and to realize that you can overcome the very struggles you might be dealing with now. So until next time, stay safe, take care. I'm Paul, the founder of Freedom in Finding Ourselves, and you can always find me over at LinkedIn or on Facebook at Mental Freedom, or you can email me at paul@freedominfindingourselves.com. Stay safe. Take care.